National Security This Week, a weekly look at American national security issues. And now, your host, John Olson.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, March 16th, and you've joined us for National Security This Week. I'm your host, John Olson. We get together here on KYMN Radio every Wednesday at 9 a.m. to discuss national security, and we're joined by guests from our local area, from around Minnesota, and from across the nation to help us explore American national security. This show covers a wide range of topics linked to national security. Our longtime listeners will know that that's true. Today, we're going to cover a topic that most people probably don't know too much about, but it's an important topic when it comes to understanding why American presidential administrations pursue certain national security policies. There are professional organizations out there that study national security issues daily, and they provide their findings to the public, to all manner of other kinds of stakeholders as well, or clients, and as the case may be. These professional organizations are often referred to as think tanks. And we've had guests on our show over the last year and a half who work in think tanks, the Brookings Institution and the Center for Strategic and International Studies as examples. Think tanks cover a wide range of topics in their research. Some of the best think tanks tend to be nonpartisan, non-aligned institutions. They do pure research, and their writing is subsequently driven by data, resulting in fact-based policy recommendations. Other think tanks are very partisan, designed to push a specific set of policies that align with political parties' agendas. I'll let you decide which one you think is most valuable to American national security interests. With us today is someone who penned a great article on the role think tanks play in American national security policy. Dr. Chad Levinson is Assistant Professor of Government and International Affairs at Virginia Tech School of Public and International Affairs. He teaches courses on international politics, American government, power and policy, the role of expertise and information in politics, and on research methods. His research has appeared in Foreign Policy Analysis, Presidential Studies Quarterly, and many other places as well. The Institute for Society, Culture, and Environment at Virginia Tech, as well as the Roosevelt Institute, the Lyndon Baines Johnson Foundation, the Eisenhower Presidential Library, and the Truman Library Institute have provided financial support for some of Dr. Levinson's research. Dr. Chad Levinson earned a Bachelor of Arts in English from Columbia University in 1997, then a Master of Science in Social Science from the University of Chicago in 2006, and he completed his doctorate in Political Science, also from the University of Chicago, in 2017. Dr. Chad Levinson, welcome to National Security This Week.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
And you and I are up on Zoom today. I can see you sitting there. It looks like your office, maybe. Is that your office that you're sitting in today?
It is the office section of my living room.
Oh, of your living room. Okay. So let's go ahead and get started on our show. I like to ask my guests a little bit more about their background when we first get going. It sort of helps, I think, our listeners understand who you are and where you come from. Dr. Levinson, what drew you to study international affairs? What was it about that topic that influenced your decisions for your graduate studies?
Well, the short answer is September 11th. Okay. The slightly longer answer is I was living in the East Village of New York City at the time. I was an underemployed computer programmer with an English degree, and it kind of lit a fire under my I went for my master's degree so I could get a job at a tech job, really, at the Council on Foreign Relations or another think tank. They all required a relevant master's degree, so I went to get one. But I got hooked on academic work. I became really interested in U.S. politics, especially the presidency, and I applied to get my PhD. I was admitted at a few places, including the University of Chicago, where I'd gotten my MA, and I decided to go there. I was going to study labor politics, actually, but there was I ended up back in the IR world because of a faculty administration rotation scheduling sort of problem, which landed me in John Mearsheimer's seminar on great power politics.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And yeah, he started asking me about theories of interest groups in national security politics. This was right after the Israel lobby came out. And that ended up being the topic of my dissertation, and he was on my committee.
Oh, wow. He's sort of a giant in the field of international relations, frankly.
That's right. And as far as people in my position can get famous, he has become famous, and in the last month or so, not necessarily for the happiest of reasons.
Yeah. You know, sometimes in the academic world, being controversial, there's nothing wrong with that because it drives discussion. And frankly, we need to have that, I think, again, in America, where we're open to a lot of different ideas and we can discuss the merits of those ideas. Yeah, so, Dr. Levinson, let's dive a little bit more into your background and what you're working on right now. What are your areas of specialization and what are you researching right now?
So I study U.S. foreign policy, in particular, the relationships between the president and private organizations. This sort of straddles the U.S. politics IR divide, which is actually often quite deep in academia. My faculty home is in an international affairs program. That's the policy world I'm really interested in. And right now I'm working on a book about extra-governmental organizations in national security politics, a book that the material starts in the interwar period and ends in the late Cold War with a kind of extended epilogue about the post-Cold War era and the global, the GWAT, the Global War on Terror. Mm-hmm. I currently have a piece about, I'm working on a piece about communication strategies that make surrogate media testimonials, like testimonials by think tank experts, effective in national security politics. Just started looking through data this last week on framing and elite cues in the New York Times coverage of the decision and the debate about invading Iraq in 2002 and 2003. I'm planning on extending that to other media sources, using sort of cutting edge, hopefully, computational text analysis techniques. So I'm not just looking at the New York Times. I have a research assistant currently working on coding a data set about Russian Facebook advertising activity during the 2016 campaign.
That's interesting.
It's sort of an old paper. And as things go in academia, it's been on the back burner for a while. So I hope I get it out the door while it's still hot enough.
Sure.
I've got a few projects in the sort of starter stage on social media as a kind of replacement for civil society. And that includes think tanks, interest groups, social movements. And finally, I mean, another on the role of social science expertise in politics and particularly in the early years of psychological warfare under the Truman administration.
So not only are you a professor who teaches plenty of courses, but you're also just doing a few things on the side. Is that what I'm hearing here?
Well, that's the thing about academia. We sort of get paid to do one job, and then we have to do a completely different job to keep that first job.
Yeah, sure. Publish or perish, right?
And it's there, some people see this as a wide sort of chasm. Do you prefer research or teaching? But My dissertation advisor put it greatly, I think, put it really well when he said that research really should be a model for teaching, right? And so the two shouldn't be as separate in our minds as they often are in our daily sort of logistical lives.
Yeah. So Professor Levinson, we have a lot to cover today. Let's go ahead and dive into our discussion on think tanks and how they sort of guide American national security policy and strategy. You are on this show today because I caught a fantastic article that you penned for the website War on the Rocks. What motivated you to write that article? And can you give our listeners just a quick summary of the key points from that article?
Sure. And thanks for saying that. That piece came out around Thanksgiving, and I was happy that people still paid attention to it despite the turkey and the traveling. Or perhaps because of the turkey in the traveling. So I was trying to understand the apparent consensus, apparent to me at least, among think tankers about the Iraq war, right? And despite all their, you know, sort of what I think of as minor differences among their justifications, whether it was for WMD, whether it was because of alleged connections to terrorism, to specific terrorist organizations, whether it was for humanitarian concerns, those are important. But when it comes to whether or not we're actually going to go in, it was a little bit like that scene in the Blues Brothers where they ask what kind of music people have, the bar plays, and they say, we got both kinds, country and Western.
Right.
different reasons to do the same thing is what it looked like to me. And I was also concerned about how little self-evaluation the war's failure inspired among them. So it was around 2019. I was walking my dog and I was listening to a podcast featuring a group of center-left think tankers who I really respect, really smart people. And one of them said that the big lesson of the past 20 years was that you can't leave a conflict too hastily. Right, referring to Obama's withdrawal from Iraq. And I reacted so vocally that I scared my dog. Right, and because to me, the bigger lesson was about the folly of unnecessary or unwise intervention in the first place. Mm-hmm. Right, so there was very little reflection to me about why the mistakes we made in deciding to go in. And more recently, I saw a lot of the same attitudes among a lot of the same people in the withdrawal from Afghanistan, even before the evacuation went sideways, to put it gently. Right? And I had this article out in Foreign Policy Analysis about Vietnam. It was based on a chapter in my dissertation, which had finally started to work when I applied this frame to it, this premise that the DC national security establishment remains wedded to interventionism. Mm. And what my piece argues is that there are two important dimensions that are often left out of most discussions about why this is the case. Right? First, people tend to focus on think tanks and other groups existing outside of government and gaining influence over it in a kind of bottom-up, outside-in fashion. And I flip that around and offer a top-down explanation of where influential groups come from. And that is when ambitious presidents face public resistance and congressional opposition, they can enlist the help of outside organizations like think tanks to help with PR, public relations. Right? And that explains a lot about the development of think tanks in foreign policy going back to the interwar period. In the case of Vietnam, Charles Colson, aide to President Nixon and infamous Watergate figure who ended up going to prison for it, he sought and received help from the American Enterprise Institute, particularly to defeat the McGovern-Hatfield Amendment to end the war in 1970. Right? And Colson rewarded them handsomely for their efforts. He conducted a fundraising campaign from within the White House that raised at least $25 million in endowment money for them and additional annual funding from major donors such as the Ford Foundation, SCAIF, Lilly and others. And this really set them up to be a major player in Washington. They'd existed for 25 years about, but they were limping along. You know, their budget was about a tenth of what Brookings was spending on an annual basis. And this really put them on the map. So that's the first part of the argument, which is about why administrations initiate these relationships, these symbiotic relationships with think tanks at particular moments. And the second part explains how and why this leads to an interventionist national security establishment. Basically, presidents are more likely to need the kind of helps that think tanks can provide when they're pursuing policies that require substantial military deployment, right? They also, these policies also attract public attention. And while the American people aren't that hard to mobilize for conflict, they aren't constantly like on the hunt for dragons to slay abroad. Right. So groups that favor interventionism get tapped as partners. They gain access to all sorts of valuable political opportunities to build their networks and cultivate constituencies. And groups that oppose interventionism are on their own. Right. And I think it's important for us to realize this imbalance in the marketplace of ideas and where it comes from. And finally, I really just enjoy telling the story about how AEI owes its prominence to helping Nixon and Colson extend the Vietnam War.
Mm. So a couple of things that I heard you say in there, I'll focus in on one because I do want to kind of clarify it in my own mind and hopefully for our listeners as well. When you talk about interventionism, are you talking specifically about active military combat operations, or do you drill down all the way to like covert action where we're trying to influence things from an interventionist perspective?
I would include all of them.
Okay.
And I would include non-military, non-kinetic means as well. Anything basically, for me, ambition means, it's a technical meaning. And this is what nerdy political scientists do. It's basically anything that requires, explicit authorization and appropriation beyond what the War Powers Act allows. So this is going to overlook some covert operations, right? Some covert operations are going to happen without informing Congress ahead of time, without being subject to the War Powers Act. So that might leave some of it out, but It would even include, I mean, in my book, it includes even the Marshall Plan,
okay, right,
which is a massive economic intervention in Western Europe.
Yeah, that's true. For our audience, you're listening to the KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. We're broadcasting out of Northfield, Minnesota. This is National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Dr. Chad Levinson, and we're discussing the role of think tanks in supporting American national security. Dr. Levinson, let's go ahead and drill down a little bit more on think tanks as a whole. What exactly is a think tank? Can you define that for us?
Yeah, it's a great question. So the term think tank applies to a really wide range of mostly not-for-profit organizations, most of which purport, at least, to conduct objective scientific research about public affairs. Now, some of them can tackle a single, narrowly defined topic like urban transit, mm-hmm, right? And some address public affairs generally. AEI, for example, doesn't confine itself to any particular policy domain or issue area. Some are more faithful to the mission of objective scientific research than others. In your introduction, you mentioned that some really do follow what they do practice what they preach, and some are fairly thinly veiled partisan outfits. And they're not just partisan outfits. So there are industry-linked research institutes, for example, and some of them model the geological effects of mineral extraction without really a preset policy objective in mind. And others just provide cover for the fossil fuel industry,
mm-hmm,
right? They call themselves institutes, but they're really they're sort of public lobbying firms in a way. There are so those are sort of industry specific and narrowly defined, and then there are these universities without students, right? And what that means, that doesn't make a lot of sense to people who aren't embedded in the university world, but most universities value research above other things. We had a brief back and forth about this a few minutes ago.
Yeah.
That students are there to, are often there to gain the benefit of working with, people who are on the front lines conducting research, and students can get involved in research. That's why somebody would choose to attend a university rather than a liberal arts college, that and sports. But a university without research then is essentially a lot of the same people that would be on a faculty at a university, but without the burden or time burden of teaching students and teaching classes, and without the benefits of teaching.
Yeah.
And joys of teaching. But that means they could focus exclusively on research across a wide range of topics.
Yeah. Put all their skills that they've learned through graduate studies to work on focusing on big problems, complex problems, coming up with maybe some thoughts on potential solutions.
Yeah, that's right. Now, and as with the sort of narrowly focused think tanks, some of them have an ideology really baked in to their DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And we can talk a little bit later about where that comes from, whether it comes from money or whether it comes from choosing people who already agree with them. But some of these think tanks have a stated mandate to support free market economics. At the same time, they're saying they're nonpartisan.
Right. Right?
So they're not party organizations, yeah, but you can be sure that if you polled the free market think tanks, they'd primarily vote for Republicans. And if you polled the social equity think tanks, they'd primarily vote for Democrats. But they're still not official party organizations. That's an important distinction.
So there's sort of they're sort of an agenda-driven element to their existence.
Yeah, I mean, these researchers have a belief structure going in, and some of the what we see about think tanks in think tanks in terms of ideology is has to be contextualized in terms of where the motivations of the organizations that funded them initially and created them initially as a reaction to biases they saw in academia, right? Because that's their main competition.
Mm-hmm.
Most of these are privately funded and operated, and the funders are going to have an influence in what these organizations say, even if it's retroactively, mm-hmm. right? You know, they're not necessarily going to mandate you say something, you say one thing and not the other. But if you do, they might decide their funding is better used elsewhere.
Right.
And you're not going to hear as much from those think tanks because they don't have the budget to operate as much.
Yeah.
The U.S. government actually has created a number of organizations, some of which people have heard of, like the RAND Organization, that are federally funded research and development centers. These are think tanks that have often a mix of corporate and government funding, both through their endowments, but also through contracts and grants. Right? And most of the research think tanks offer is public, but others will report directly and privately to their clients, like consulting firms. Mm-hmm. So a lot of clients for RAND are, you know, it's the DOD, it's the Air Force, and a lot of those reports are not going to be made public because of security reasons.
Yeah, classified reporting, sure.
Yeah.
Let me ask you.
Think tanks, yeah.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Within corporations, by the way, corporations will set up internal think tanks to look for business development opportunities. But my work is really focused on those that are incorporated independently and contribute to the public affairs discourse in some way.
I'm gonna ask you what I think is going to be a complex question, and I'm going to probably put you on the spot with this one, but hopefully you can give us an answer that will make sense. What role do think tanks play in the public policy arena? And specifically what I'm talking about is how does the research done inside those think tanks work its way into civil discourse, and specifically on the national security policy side? Obviously, the ecosystem is filled with different think tanks addressing different elements of public policy in general. But we're going to try and narrow the scope of this down sort of into the national security arena, if we could. So how does that research make it into civil discourse?
Great question. I mean, think tanks sort of ideas enter the discourse primarily in two broad sort of categories. Similar to lobbying, where there's an inside route and an outside route, right? And by that, I mean the inside route goes through elite channels.
Okay. And what do you mean by that? Elite channels.
Elite channels. These are, first of all, other think tankers, government decision makers and their staff.
So political leaders, really, is what you're talking about.
Political leaders. Yeah, elite is one of those terms. It's a term of art in academia and thank you for reminding me. I have to clarify what I mean by that. So, you could think the world in our world is divided between the elites and the mass public. So you could see how sort of crude a sort of dichotomy that might be.
It's a framework. You have to have a framework from which to initiate your studies, right?
That's right. That's right. So it sort of stays. If you stretch the concept of the elite a little bit, it could be anyone who pays serious attention to public policy. So they could be, the elite can include academics like myself, like I said, other think tankers. Part of why I went to graduate school was because I was a very naive mass public member when I called the Council on Foreign Relations and asked them when I could come to their next meeting. And they said, never, unless we send you an invitation.
Yeah.
Right. So it could be anyone with an invitation to CFR meetings. And that helps understand this inside route. Right. So that inside channel can include, you know, these members only conferences, meetings and workshops. Research reports that have a restricted distribution list, not necessarily classified, but you know, it's a club in a sense. Also, we have private meetings with decision makers. You know, you don't call it lobbying, but it's essentially it can be difficult to distinguish to make out the difference between those two. And sometimes the inside route sort of stays inside, and think tanks help build consensus among the members of the national security establishment. And when there's a solid science-based consensus about an issue, and when this consensus doesn't threaten the material interests of important stakeholders, think tankers can sort of stick to the inside route, and they go public with a kind of unified front when the time is right. Right. the think tank world has decided X, right? And now it's time to tell the public this is what's going to happen. And the president goes and makes a big speech about it. And Congress, that's State of the Union, stands up and applauds in unison. But then, of course, you know, science doesn't trump politics, quite the opposite.
Yeah.
So when elites can't reach a consensus, or when a prominent decision maker or vested interest find themselves in the minority, they can take things outside, right? And make the issue part of the public debate. And this happens through, if it's initiated through think tanks. Think tanks maintain, as a matter of professional practice, relationships with media, right? Yep. So op-ed pages in major newspapers, general interest magazines like The Atlantic magazine, or more narrowly focused publications like Foreign Policy, give think tankers a forum for expressing their ideas, participating in the national security debate. And some of these try to maintain balance, and others are more loyal to a particular ideology or party and set of think tanks. Now, think tanks can try to skip straight to this outside route, right, without participating in this elite coordination step. But that's generally more difficult because there's a clubbiness to the national security establishment. And like all clubs, you need an invitation or a member to vouch for you. Mm-hmm. I've called my book project The Credibility Cartel.
Oh, yeah.
Because of this clubbiness that shapes who the media treats seriously. And a voucher from a powerful member of a political party can work, as can a voucher from a think tank with an established reputation. In my opinion, nothing beats the White House as a source of credibility. And in particular, the Republican Party has, in each administration since Gerald Ford, using something called the White House Office of Public Liaison, promoted the fortunes of think tanks and other organizations that align with their interests and preferences. They may have been a little less successful at this during the Trump years. Democratic administrations, by the way, changes the name of this office when they take power, and they call it either the Office of Civic Engagement or the Office of Public Engagement. In my view, they've been a lot less strategic about using this office to promote their extra-governmental partners, but read the book and figure out why. I haven't quite figured out why yet myself.
Fair enough. So we know that the ecosystem is filled with lots of different kinds of think tanks. Even in the national security area, there's a lot of different think tanks out there. Some on the nonpartisan part, and then we have think tanks that veer off into various gradations of left or right perspective. In that national security arena, you've studied this. Which think tanks wield the greatest influence among American policymakers, and why are those particular think tanks so influential in presidential administrations?
So the why of it for me always sort of boils down to these think tanks reflecting some sort of big structural decision that has happened in sometimes the recent past and sometimes the more distant past. So to me, what do I mean by that? So to me, the most influential think tanks are probably those that formed in the context of the world wars, right? And the subsequent construction of the so-called liberal international order, right? And you've heard of them, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Brookings Institution, Hoover, the Russell Sage Foundation, the Atlantic Council. The 70s, and this is to me why the Vietnam War is so important, right? In the 70s, you sort of see the rise of the conservative think tank movement as counter programming to Brookings and academia, right? And for me, this got off the ground with AEI, right? And the help that Colson gave them in exchange for their help in keeping the war going in Vietnam, right? So, This movement includes the American AEI, the Heritage Foundation, Hudson, and a lot of these institutions may have existed prior to this rise, but they were given a real boost in funding and attention and access, and especially after the formation of the Office of Public Liaison under Ford. By the way, the Office of Public Liaison's first director was a man named William Baruti Jr., And if you want to know who William Baruti Sr. was, you look at the masthead of the American Enterprise Institute. He was its president.
Okay.
Right. So there was an intimate connection there. And this is not to insinuate corruption, but rather to say that, you know, this, a lot of this influence starts at the top, mm-hmm. and the president has a lot of power to sort of restructure the environment when under particular circumstances. And I won't get into the nerdy sort of social science aspect of it right now. But these conservative groups proliferated through the 1980s. And by the 90s, the liberals realized they needed to respond. And so they created some of their own sort of nonpartisan, but not really, organizations like the Center for American Progress. And that's the linear narrative. But each administration really produces its own set of alumni who can attract funding and create institutions or redirect institutions. And in fact, there's always some segment of a winning presidential campaign that splinters off, doesn't join the government, and instead starts organizing the extra governmental aside of the administration sort of from the jump. Right? And as for there's a question about their involvement in specific policies, I think, too. And some of their influence is shaped by things outside of their control and often outside of the president's control, right? So there's sort of variation across domains in how much decision makers depend on outside organizations to formulate ideas and to mobilize support for their chosen strategies. So some areas of the world are well covered by in-house resources, right? So this limits think tank influence over decision makers because the government can develop its own ideas.
Right. Is that sort of the role of the National Security Council staff to do some of those things?
That's right. Well, in the rise of the National Security Staff, as an historical narrative, helps us understand why there was sort of a generation of think tankers that was super influential in the 1940s.
Yeah.
And then throughout the 1950s and 60s, as the NSC staff grows and becomes professionalized, the areas that are left for outside groups to specialize in are fewer and fewer, at least without some competition from the inside.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because these groups and outside groups in general gain influence when they have informational advantages.
Right.
Right. Over policymakers. And that's not just national security. That's across the board. National security happens to be an area where the government is, I don't know, maybe operates at parity with the outside world. It's not, same isn't true for technology and various trade and agriculture, yeah. Et cetera.
Information is power.
Yes, information is power. But these groups, even when the government has their own resources, these groups still have influence over the public, right?
Yeah.
And can be effective partners for the administration, right? They could write editorials in newspapers, organize conferences. They could do things administrations can't do because administrations' hands are tied with respect to what we would call propaganda.
Yeah.
Right. If they can launder that propaganda, they can launder that information through these outside groups. So Kenneth Pollack, for example, like he was sort of everywhere at once during the 2002 debate about the Iraq War. Right. Ben Rhodes, built this echo chamber of think tankers during the debate about the JCPOA. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's the kind of partnership I'm most interested in. I think it gets overlooked.
Yeah.
Also, the public cares about certain issues more than others.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Some issues, they have well-developed constituencies with set ideas about what the U.S. should do. And this boosts the think tankers' influence and independence because they could work like domestic interest groups often do, exerting leverage over office holders by mobilizing their constituents to vote, raise money, participate in all sorts of other ways. In these cases, think tanks can engage in what we call the mobilization of bias.
Mm.
Which is engaging people who've already made up their mind, right, to get involved in politics, right, and to by raising the salience of an issue that has a built-in pool of supporters waiting to champion it.
Yeah. So I just want to highlight for the listeners and make sure that I'm not putting words in your mouth, but I want to make sure that that I frame this correctly. When you talk about think tanks that lean to the left or lean to the right, they have influence. That influence on policy isn't necessarily bad. either right or left. It's irrelevant. It's only bad if they get it wrong. Is that a good way to say that?
That's right. That's right. So, you know, I think extending the Vietnam War was bad, right? Think tankers had a hand in that. I think the Marshall Plan was good. Think tankers had a hand in that.
Sure.
I mean, I've chosen, right? And by the way, you know, the Vietnam War wasn't a left-right issue.
Right.
Right. Right. Part, you know, Johnson did it as Johnson did as well. The only reason he didn't start off with think tanks from the beginning was that the war was popular.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
Early on. And by the way, Johnson helped Colson raise money for AEI. Right. This is so it's definitely it's not a left good, right, bad kind of issue.
Yeah. And back then, I mean, sure, we had kind of two different sides of the aisle, but the polarization wasn't anywhere near what it is today. So in a historical construct, you know, politics sort of ended at the border traditionally in America at that time. Anything that was happening.
Edge.
Yeah. Water's edge there. That anything happening overseas, we came together to deal with. Much like in many regards, we're coming together now as a country to deal with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, hopefully.
Yeah. I mean, the polarization story is complicated and interesting as well. And I think that the Vietnam War had more of a causal effect on the polarization of politics, on the alignment of different polarizing dimensions in American politics, but that's sure. A nerdy story.
Well, I mean, there's no question about it that the U.S. involvement in Vietnam really sort of drove a wedge into American society in ways that we're frankly still dealing with. For our audience, you're listening to KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. This is National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Dr. Chad Levinson, and we're discussing the role of think tanks in supporting American national security. So, Dr. Chad Levinson, we've covered a lot of ground so far with regard to the influence that think tanks have on the creation of American national security sort of policies, I guess. Maybe we could dive into the role they play in advocating for specific national security strategies. And I define this sort of this way. Maybe we need to understand your view on the difference between policy and strategy. And I ask that because I think it's important people understand there's a huge chasm, frankly, between stating a desired set of outcomes, that's policy, and achieving those outcomes through sort of a coherent, integrated, comprehensive strategy that can achieve those outcomes over time through achieving milestones, even against opposition. That's what a strategy is supposed to do in achieving your policy strategy match. What is your take on that in American foreign affairs? What role do think tanks play in creating that policy strategy match in support of an administration?
Okay, so, I mean, there's all sorts of different sort of label sets for strategy and policy, goals versus means.
Yeah, ends, ways, means, all that kind of stuff, right? Yeah.
Right. So if we say that, you know, strategy is the way you get something done and policy is the thing you want to get done, I'm happy to go with that. But I might slip up because
you use. That's fine.
That's right. Well, no, I'll stick with yours. That's fine because I took my notes this way. So, so to me, think tanks have more influence over strategy than policy.
Okay.
Especially when it comes to the big decisions, right? Presidents and administrations have a lot of initiative in this domain with fewer constraints against that initiative built into the system. And administrations have their own ideas and agendas coming in. They often, not always, have a lot of expertise available to them, or at least they have a set of theories, even if those theories are written by people we might not consider very bright at times. But there are a lot of theories about how to deploy America's really vast capabilities to achieve their policy outcomes. Which is one of two elements of strategy. That is, will this work if we try it? Right. Here, think tanks can participate as sounding boards for administrative initiatives, but they're competing with the NSC, right?
Yeah.
With the National Security, with the policy planning staff at the State Department, with the DOD's massive bureaucracy, right? Not to mention the FFRDCs, the federally funded research development centers that have greater access to sensitive information than they do. than outside groups do. So they have some influence with this aspect of strategy, but I think I'm still being pretty generous when I say they're operating at rough parity with the executive branch, right? And as I said before, outside groups have the most influence when they have informational advantages. It's the other element of strategy, dealing with the opposition, congressional and the public opposition, where think tanks, I think, have the most influence, right? Marketing a strategy, validating it independently, even though they're often collaborating partners with the administration. So if the first element of strategy is, will this work if we try it? Then this element is, will we get to try it in the first place?
Yeah.
And if they can maintain their political, their sort of image of political independence, they can persuade a lot more people to go along with the administration's plan and try to secure that match between policy and strategy, right? You can think of this as information laundering, right? To make a claim or an appeal appear more legitimate and apolitical than it would coming from a member of the administration, right? Or the president, him or herself, which basically half the country is predisposed to disbelieve.
Right. At least right now. So what I think I'm hearing you say, and let me frame it in another question for you as well, after I sort of summarize this a bit. So the administration has, under the executive branch, all of the different departments of the executive branch, DOD, state, commerce, energy, et cetera, each of those departments has their own internal policy creation function. Most of them have some sort of an intelligence component, analysis capability. So they sort of know what they want to pursue from a policy perspective. A lot of administrations, a lot of presidents give a lot of leeway to their secretaries, department secretaries, to pursue agendas along those lines. But the think tanks also exist in there to sort of either give cover to the administration to pursue it, or maybe oppose that those policies. In the case of opposition, are the think tanks connecting more with members of Congress in the opposition so that they have a voice or an influence through Congress in the checks and balances that we have built into our political system? Is that sort of how this is shaping up in your mind?
Yeah, that's a great observation and question. So, you know, I go on and on about how the president has this top-down role. Members of Congress do the same thing, or at least they try, right? But on, you know, the same advantages that apply to the presidency over members of Congress in the conduct of national security because of, you know, certain aspects of the written into the Constitution, certain things that have just become practice over the 200 some years of our republic. The president has, we call it the two presidencies thesis, right? So if you have domestic policy and foreign policy, the president has a freer hand in foreign policy, especially as policy initiator, not totally free, and it varies over time. Those, you know, if a group has a if an outside group, a think tank, has a benefactor in the White House, that's going to accrue the same advantages over a group that has a benefactor in the Senate. And in fact, we talk about the there's dirty tricks can apply here too. When I talk about the McGovern-Hatfield Amendment to end the war, there was an amendment to end the war committee, right, which is essentially doing the same thing as the extra governmental organizations assisting Colson were doing. And Colson floated the idea of having them investigated by the IRS, which is something that, you know, the White House can suggest to the IRS that they might investigate somebody. That plan was scuttled, by the way, as being a little too far over his skis.
But, yeah. Totally inappropriate, yes. Right? Totally inappropriate.
Inappropriate, and also, like, you know, guess what? The people in Congress were smart enough to know how not to violate the law.
Yeah.
And that was the conclusion of some of the internal people in the White House at the time. So, yes, this is not a one-sided game, right? The opposition is playing the same game. Also, there are constituencies, there are think tanks and interest groups that have built-in relationships with sort of more permanent members of the bureaucracy in various departments. And so they might be able to plug into Commerce or even DoD and bypass the administration. The thing is, over the decades, the administration has corralled a lot of that policy planning capability closer and closer to the White House. Mm-hmm. Right? There's been a great deal of centralization. The National Security Council is really the focus of this.
Yeah.
The National Security Council is a White House, it's an executive office of the president organization.
Yep.
Right. Which gives the president more direct power over it and influence over it than something located at state or DOD or Commerce.
Yeah, I like to think of the National Security Council staff working directly for the president is really the hub of and then the spokes are all the different elements of either executive branch or external government, non-governmental organizations that influence American national security policy and strategy development. And I'd like to ask you a little bit more. Maybe we can go into some specific examples here. We got about 15 minutes left. When we talk about strategy, can you give maybe some specific examples of how think tanks have provided a presidential administration with a coherent strategy in executing American foreign policy? You mentioned Vietnam. Are there any other areas that you think are appropriate here as a case studies?
Yeah, I mean, I think of two examples. I mean, I'm generally skeptical of think tanks being a sort of source of strategic innovation.
Mm-hmm.
But they can probably have a role in responding to requests for help, right, or particular needs at moments of political peril. So an old example I have is the Destroyers for Bases deal in World War II.
Yep.
So FDR wants to help Great Britain without getting into a shooting war with Germany. And a think tanker named Clark M. Eichelberger suggests, at least according to Eichelberger, that we trade a bunch of aging U.S. naval destroyers in exchange for access to British naval stations around the Atlantic. So he takes credit for that idea as a strategic innovation.
Okay.
The Iraq surge is an interesting example, too. Right. So here you had a situation where the administration has just been thumped in the 2006 midterms. And the Iraq study group had just delivered their recommendation to draw down U.S. coalition troops. But the president and his closest civilian advisors had rejected that idea. And they were looking for an alternative, something that might help them claim victory. And then along comes AEI and Fred Kagan with the New Way Forward report, which is a supposed blueprint for the surge. And a few weeks later, President Bush is announcing a troop increase, right, at the State of the Union address.
Mm-hmm.
And Kagan provided what might be sound analysis or unsound analysis. But either way, he was pushing on an open door.
Yeah. And if I remember correctly, that surge sort of coincided with the Sunni awakening in Iraq, which really helped mm-hmm. to tamp down on the success of al-Qaeda forces, insurgent forces inside Iraq, really gave us an opportunity to succeed in Iraq, at least temporarily at that time frame.
Right. And then we basically started calling anything that seemed to be working the surge.
Right. Yeah. I said the same thing about the surge during the Obama administration into Afghanistan to try
That's
and
right.
recapitalize our efforts in Afghanistan. You'd mentioned earlier about the fact that think tanks rely pretty heavily on funding. Some mm-hmm. of it's contracts, some of it's grants, some of it's private donors, that kind of thing. How does this need for funding impact a think tank's recommendations with regards to policy and strategy?
Well, some think tanks work on a client service or contract model, right? And that can certainly introduce bias into the research process. By the way, especially a bias towards recommending action because that requires further research.
Ah, yes, there we go.
And future Congress. But perhaps more typically, it introduces bias towards pleasing the client. Right. But that's just not just contract based research. Right. So Koch funded opportunities these days are targeted at researchers with a commitment to foreign policy restraint. Hmm. And that's written into the grants that they write.
OK.
So those institutes aren't technically working on a client service model, but the researchers aren't going to conclude that the U.S. or aren't likely to conclude that the U.S. should ramp up its defense spending and police every corner of the globe. Now, mm-hmm. by the way, I agree a lot with a lot of these researchers these days, but that's beside the point, right? I'd be very surprised if knowing who they are and what they stand for, that they would do that, not just because of their funders, but because of who their funders chose. There's a selection process mm-hmm. that goes on here.
I'll just very quickly comment that really brings up the broader question of, does America need a grand strategy to sort of limit what it is we're doing out there in the world to give us a focus of what we're doing? And I actually had Stephen Walt and Ron Krebs on the show at the end of last year talking about, does America need a grand strategy? So Dr. Levinson, thank you for hitting on that, because that is yet another indication that we probably need something to give us a little guidance out there in what we're trying to accomplish around the world.
I listened to that episode. Krebs and Walt are two people I respect immensely. One of them was actually a mentor of mine for a very short period
of
time.
All right.
There's a question here though about reputational costs to these think tanks, about who their clients are. Right. So people will sort of dismiss the Quincy Institute, which is the name of it, for taking Koch funding. Right. And the people who dismiss them for that wouldn't necessarily dismiss them for taking Soros funding as well. Everyone else dismisses them for taking Soros funding. And perhaps that's fair. Right. So maybe not. It's sort of not for me to say. But these can cause scandals. If the money comes from foreign governments, by the way, it can be worse.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Even if that country is Norway, right, who we think of as friendly, because it might be against the law, right? Mm-hmm. The Foreign Agents Registration Act requires that that advocacy work identify its non-U.S. sources of funding. But nobody blinks when it's the U.S. government paying the bill.
Yeah. Right?
And that can introduce bias, too.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So... think of Colson and Nixon, right? So Nixon resigns in disgrace, Colson goes to prison, but right, the legacy we live in is theirs.
That's true.
Right?
Yeah.
Because of the institutions that they helped build. And it's not just about them, it's the legacy of the slogan peace through strength, or peace with dignity, whichever one you want to choose, right? Which really just meant keeping our troops in Vietnam long past the time they should have been.
Yeah. So Dr. Levinson, I'm going to give you the floor as we sort of start to close out the show for today. What else should people know about think tanks, how they work, how they influence American national security policy and strategy, or anything else you'd like to share? I'll give you just a few minutes, because there's some other follow-up questions I'd like to ask if I could.
Sure. Really briefly, I mean, I do want to say I'm often critical and skeptical of think tanks. My skepticism should not be focused on the individual researchers themselves, right? Or even any piece of research that is produced, right? These are smart people doing their best, committed to what they think is American national interest. So I do want to recognize that.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think we need to recognize that we don't have a free and open marketplace of ideas, right? There are thumbs on the scales in all sorts of places. And it's not just from the usual suspects, you know, big piles of money, right? It's also from people who we elect to political office and we expect them to play it straight. And they're often not, right? Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of our attention about the relationship between government and think tanks should focus on those top level decision makers who are using think tanks to launder their arguments.
So Dr. Chad Levinson, are there any articles you'd recommend our listeners read, other than obviously your piece in War on the Rocks, which frankly people should absolutely read? Maybe a book, perhaps. Anything else that you would recommend listeners pick up so they can understand this world of think tanks a little bit more?
All right. Being an academic, I have a lot of suggestions, probably more than you want to hear. There's an article on a Brookings blog in 2014 by someone named Jeremy Shapiro, whom I don't know, where he describes the experience of a think tanker giving advice as a kind of pantomime, which is a humorous take. But more seriously, I think Stephen Wertheim's book, Tomorrow the World, is a great history of how think tankers were able to influence major foreign policy shift. I use Donald Abelson's A Capital Idea as a sort of foundational text when I teach. E.J. Fagan has a couple of papers on elite polarization and issue salience as drivers of demand for think tank expertise. Austin Carson and Matthew Conklin have a piece they're working on right now about CFR's consensus building role. So keep an eye out for that. Anyone who's interested in foreign policy influence should look at Paul Avey and Mike Desch's surveys of policymakers and the reliance on think tanks. And then finally, I think there's a lot of good work on NGOs as knowledge networks. For example, Jennifer Haddon's work on climate advocacy. And then I think Jennifer Victor's work on social network analysis of interest groups can suggest a lot about how we can understand think tanks as well.
Okay. And one more time, what are you researching these days? A new book maybe coming out anytime soon? Publish or perish,
primarily,
right?
Sorry?
Publish or perish, right?
Publish or perish. So yes, it's primarily the book project that the War on the Rocks piece introduces. I have some good news about that. That's not official yet, so I can't get more specific.
But, okay.
But the publish or perish, the balance is favoring is in favor of against of published instead of perish these days. So,
okay.
I have a few sort of related research streams. First is how think tank credibility is established and deployed in media appearances. And that's related to a sort of deep research tradition on message framing and elite cues. I have a completed manuscript about that, and I'll be presenting a follow-up piece about the Iraq War at the Midwest Political Science Association in Chicago just next month. Piece I mentioned about the 2016 Russian campaign of meddling in the presidential election, about how foreign disinformation can bandwagon on domestic political conflicts and circumstances. I have some material I'd love to get back to from the Truman Archives about social science and psychological warfare, and looking at the way social media regulation can help us, how we should look at social media regulation, primarily instead of regulating the tech companies. I'm looking into whether or not we should be regulating government again, which we did for many decades until the rise of the internet.
Yeah, that's an interesting approach. Dr. Chad Levinson, thank you so much for joining us today on National Security This Week.
Well, and thank you so much for having me. We professors like nothing more than to talk, so thanks for giving me the opportunity to reach some new listeners.
Okay. That closes this week's edition of National Security This Week. We're on KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. I'm your host, John Olson. Thank you for joining us today. I look forward to sharing time with you again next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Thank you for listening to National Security This Week here on KYMN Radio. Have a great finish to your week, everyone. Take care.
You've been listening to National Security This Week, a weekly show looking into issues of American national security with the host, John Olson. Listen every Wednesday at 9 a.m. for National Security This Week.
Mayor Rhonda Pownell invites the entire Northfield community to the 2022 State of the City Address on Monday, March 21st at 6:30 p.m. at Carlton